What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
The Surfer's Journal is the pinnacle of thoughtful, meticulously curated writing and imagery within the surf world. The publication was founded in 1992 by Steve Pesman, along with his wife Debbie, which, with the addition of his 20 years publishing Surfer magazine, makes him the surf world's most experienced publisher. In today's episode of Surf Splendor, Steve shares stories of his youth shaping surfboards, riding cosmic waves with Timothy Leary, the friends he's made along the way, and the legacy of the Surfer's Journal. I'm your host, David Scales, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Steve Pesman.
When I started surfing in like 1957, and you know, and back then there was only a few hundred surfers around, so you felt like you're in on something pretty special and something kind of secret, and you felt like the rest of the world were sort of unknowing, a little bit dorkish, and you were very cool because you knew what the real deal was. And yeah, surfing, just the sensation of surfing and everything about it, the culture, just everything was so appealing that it, you know, you got what John Severson, one of his first surf movies, was called Surf Fever. And that's what you got when you tried it.
I think no matter what you're doing when you're a teenager, you feel that a little bit, you know, even if it's playing video games.
That's probably right.
But there is certainly something unique.
Yeah, well, I went from a L.A. city kid who didn't know how to swim to a surfer in the space of about two and a half years. And so I was the, you know, in elementary school, I was the kid that when they were dividing up teams, the teacher had to say at the end, okay, you go there, you go there. But later on in school, I kind of came into my size, and I was a pretty good athlete, but never a team guy. And surfing became my sense of self-identity. And it was hugely important to me. And, you know, the guy started with that, a 41 Ford pickup truck, and we built a grass shack on the back, and we'd go down to the Huntington Cliffs and spend the weekend there. And, you know, it was just really fascinating, trying to get good enough so we could show our face at the pier where the cool guys hung out.
Which is still the way it is today.
Well, it kind of is. You know, Tom Morey, who invented the boogie board, made the comment that surfing is a lot like walking the picket fence for your girlfriend. And most of this, it's uncanny how most of the surf spots are easily viewable, you know, from the pier, from here, from there. But, and so it's really an audience, although it's a personal thing, you're really surfing for approval a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so it's kind of an interesting thing. But anyway, I shipped out, I went to Hawaii in the winter of 62, 63, and rode big waves, rode Waimea Bay and Sunset and all that stuff. And I came back, I was pretty full of myself. And I ended up working for Mickey Munoz at Ole Surfboards. Hobie had just bought it, and I was his left-hand man. And I learned a lot from him. He was a, a kid in the late 40s into the 50s of Malibu, iconic California surf personality, and he's still going with SUP, and he's an incredible athlete and a wonderful guy, very bright.
I'm actually interviewing him for the podcast as well.
Yeah, he's a national treasure. And then I shipped out in the Merchant Marine. I worked for a juvenile hall as a night attendant at forestry camps for LA County delinquent boys because my dad had been a camp director who got me in. Anyway, and then I shipped out in the Merchant Marine in 1965 on a ship with 8,600 tons of hams and slits due for PXs, you know, for our fighting troops in Vietnam. 1965 was early. And that was a 6-month voyage where the crew rebelled against the officers, and there was all kinds of stuff that went down on that. But it was pretty incredible and a great experience. I came back, and soon after that, a friend of mine, Bill Wetzel, was asked by Foss Foam, that was a secondary foam supplier, but, you know, large.
Yeah.
He said, I have like 5,000 second blanks I don't know what to do with, and I think they'd be more marketable if they were shaped. So I want you to shape them. So this guy, my friend Bill, got me to team shape with him, and he taught me how to use the tools. And so he'd do the first step. He'd outline, I'd band, he'd, you know, contour and sand, and we just switch back and forth. And so over a period of the summer, we both team shaped about 2,000 boards.
Oh my gosh.
And we got $6 a piece. And he got 4 and I got 2, which was appropriate. Finally, you know, I went back to my home range, which was Huntington Beach, Seal Beach, and started shaping. And we started a surfboard business. Stu and I started shaping shaping for surf shops that make their own boards. And we built a shaping machine that would cut the rocker and the blank with one pass on the top and one pass on the bottom. You know, we had to invent.
Yeah.
We had to learn how to do something. That was the basic lesson of that for us. And I learned how to shape pretty well. And the deal about shaping surfboards is learning how to use the tools and control the tools. And the fewer times you touch the board, the more true and refined your shape will be. So scrubbing away and all that stuff means you're kind of whittling.
Mm.
But if you take big, bold cuts and go right to where you want to be, real quick and efficient, those are the shapes that turn out to be the good ones.
Wow.
And you remove foam and patterns, like you kind of sweep it off and sweep it off and blend and stuff. And learning how to read foam, like you pick the blank up from the tail and look, and you have side lights that cast a shadow across the board. And learning how to read the foam is a big part of it. Like, if this curve goes down like that and this curve goes down but a little less down than this one, then you go over and you adjust it. And so it's a very logical process.
Yeah.
And that requires just tool control. So if you had to, the more abstract the tool, the harder it is to control.
Mm-hmm.
The more you can control the cutting blade. So a hand plane is infinitely more controllable than a power planer because you can see the blade, you see the shaving peeling through it, and you know exactly what's going on.
Right.
So it's an interesting intellectual chess game that combined with surfboard theory, which is a foil kind of concept like a wing. And we were like alchemists, you know. We were the shapers have always been an integral part of the sport, and surfing's always been unique because the boards, for the most part, until the last decade or two, have been handmade for each person, for the most part. And there's no other sport with as much of a following where what you use to do it is handmade for you. And yet, they were only like $500, $700. I mean, ridiculously cheap.
Right.
And there was no profit in it because no one could mark the board up because you can buy a blank and get it shape it and get it glassed for $400, and that controlled the price. So it was a funny deal, very high level of art and skill, and no profit. But you would be paid for your craft. So, you know, when I started shaping, you made $10 a board, and it took, I don't know, you know, 2 or 3 hours. Nowadays, shapers get anywhere from $35 to $100 a board normally, and it takes them an hour or so. So it's, you know, you can make a living, a good living, but, you know, it's not really healthy, but it's kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
But I feel bad for people that are in their 60s and still shaping because they never developed any other resource for supporting themselves.
Right.
Because it gets old and it gets hard, and so it's a funny thing.
Yeah.
It's the same for people that surf. You see them abandon most of societal's normal roles in order to dedicate themselves to surfing. And at first you're jealous of them because you're going to work and they're surfing. And you're doing this and they're traveling to some perfect place somewhere. But eventually, as you grow older, the comfort of having children and a family and all those things, and the lack of it in their lives becomes really very profound. You know, Mickey Dora was famous for saying, when the surf's good, I'm on it, and when it isn't, I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
I'm not a surfer. Don't call me a surfer. I'm not a surfer.
Right.
I just ride waves when it's good.
For posterity's sake, can you tell me about Peterson Surfing in 19...
Peterson's International Surfing?
Yeah.
Well, my relationship... It was started, I think, by Leroy Granis, and then it went through some ownership phases. It ended up being published by Dick Graham, who was a jock, a basketball player at Chapman College, and a Marine out of the Marine Corps, and a cool guy, and a real athlete, but not and a body surfer and a diver, but not really a board surfer. And he was publishing Surfing Magazine because... the opportunity fell into his lap, and he had a kind of opening at Peterson, and so he was on it. So he hired a buddy of his named Duke Boyd, who had just started Hang Ten, which was the first real mass-produced authentic surfwear. Mm-hmm. And he hired Duke to merchandise Peterson's International Surfing Magazine, like he merchandised his clothing line. Because Duke hung out at Huntington and gave trunks to the cool guys and said, hey, wear these, give them back to me after a while, let me see how they do. And he'd drive to Rincon and give guys a ride. And he surfed himself, but so he was milking this kind of underground surf culture for its authenticity and injecting it into his Hang Ten line and injecting it into Peterson Surfing Magazine. So he came to Stu and I and asked us to write a technical article about surfboard design.
Yeah.
Basic elements of surfboard theory. And this is the article that we wrote. And Surfer, John Severson at Surfer was the leading magazine.
Sure.
And he went, oh. And so he got this physicist that surfed, Terry Hendricks from La Jolla, to write a technical article that was really a technical article, you know.
Yeah.
But this started... a relationship with that surfing magazine where I wrote travel articles and,
sure.
and so forth. And then one day they Duke said, hey, you want to come inside and be an editor? So I did. And about 6 months later, that magazine folded. And so I went down to Surfer and said, hey, could I contribute articles to you guys? And they had kind of gotten to know who I was because they sold us advertising for our surf shop, and they kind of knew that I shaped. And they said, well, you know, our editor is leaving. He had a salary dispute with John, and he's leaving. He wanted $1,100 a month, and John was only paying him $1,000, so he quit. And John's going to take over editing the book, but he'd like to have someone work to do the, you know, do the letters and just do the donkey work. And I said, great. And they said, well, how much were you making at surfing? And I was making $500. I told him $700. And he said, well, would you take $600? I said, yeah. And all of a sudden I was at Surfer. Well, little did I know that John had recently sold the magazine to a holding company that had put together by a guy named Bud Fabian, who had just moved to Monarch Bay and was had retired from being the CEO of Hunt's Foods. And he was a corporate turnaround guy. His face was on Time magazine for turning around Dresser Tool, which is a big oil tool company. And John was in an earnout, kind of running it during a transition time and looking for a publisher. And somehow I ended up, he took me to lunch one day and he said, "Well, I guess you're it." And I said, "I'm what?" And he said, you want to be the publisher of Surfer?" And I kind of choked. And he said, "Don't worry." He says, "You edit for 3 or 4 hours a day, publish for an hour a day, and go surfing. It'll be good for you. Keep it 5 years." So I accepted, and it was a going magazine, 10 years old, when I became the publisher. And everyone there knew what to do, so they kept me propped up.
Sure.
And because I was the insulation from the holding company for Better Living.
Yeah.
And eventually, over a period of 10 or 15 years, I figured publishing out. And I stayed at that. I stayed at Surfer for 21 years as a publisher. And then Debbie, who, when I left there, had become the ad director for Surfer, and I both, we were married at the time, and we both left to do the Journal.
Well, in your piece with Timothy Leary, which we'll talk about.
That was mid-70s.
Yeah, we'll talk about that at length, but one of the things that he discusses is the importance of timing and how surfers are very attuned to like capitalizing the exact moment when an opportunity arises. Can you tell me about the timing of launching the Surfer's Journal and like what was the surfing zeitgeist at that time? And well, was there a niche being unfulfilled, you know? That what was the impetus for the journal?
There was a couple of things going on there. One was Surfer had an aging demographic. When I took over in 70, the average age was 16. And when I left in 91, the average age was 24. And an art director came in named David Carson, who later published a book called The End of Print. And he was a designer that was anarchistic. He was trying to overthrow all the accepted principles of magazine design. And he was very bright and gifted. He had a great eye for photos, but he would put type in the gutter, make it upside down, do kind of break the rules, which was very cool with the young people, but the older guys were having trouble reading it, you know. And so when I left Surfer, the older readership had been disenfranchised.
Got it.
And that created an opportunity. But also, advertising, the normal surf magazines, in fact, all magazines for the most part, were driven by advertising. And I'd had a relative by marriage during my first marriage who published journals. He lived in Pennsylvania. And he would publish a journal a month on different things and repeat them every year. And so he would go to the intelligence community and get experts on technology that applied to that activity and have them write on the cutting edge topics for that and publish a journal. And if there was 1,872 people in the intelligence community, he'd print 1,872 copies and he'd sell them to them for $150 a piece. But really it was a newsletter, or it was a journal that wasn't deluxe in its physicality, but it was very intensive in its content. And they all had to have it.
Yeah.
So the deal was he charged as much as he needed to make it worthwhile doing.
Yeah.
So we thought, let's do an all-content surf magazine, because all the readers always say, "Oh, too much advertising, too much advertising." So let's do an all-content magazine and charge what we need to make it viable.
Yeah.
So we came out with a journal at $12.95, and we had six advertisers instead of 40% advertising. And that was, it was so different than anything else that was going on, because there's a lot of new age publications now that are enabled by electronic media and so forth. But that was, surfing prior to that had been mostly served by traditional format sports magazines that tried to carry as much advertising as they could get and charged a comfortable cover price and sold the magazines at a loss and made it up with ad revenue. That's the traditional magazine model. So our model was make it for $5 and sell it for $10. And so it was a book business, but our idea was to sell these books by subscription 4 times a year.
Can I interrupt you real quick?
Yeah.
You talk about kind of this higher level of content, quality mm-hmm. of content. I feel like traditionally surf, whatever, print media or whatever, pander kind of to the Spicoli stereotype. Was there any concern of yours that there wouldn't be a market for this higher quality content?
You know, Bruce Brown, I asked Bruce Brown how he did his movies, and he said he made movies for himself. And he was just lucky somebody else liked him too.
Okay.
And so when I left Surfer, I was 50 years old, and I had no interest in pandering to the lowest common denominator, which at the time surfing was doing very much. Surfer slightly less. Severson, when he started Surfer, he was an art teacher and a brainy guy, and he published a fiction called Malibu Lizards in the first issue of Surfer, where no one went surfing. And it was, and he did his cartoons and Murphy and all, you know, he kind of did a lot of kid shit in Surfer, but really, he coached me when I came in into his group. He said, never underestimate the intelligence of your readership, and never be afraid that you're going to go over its head. So I always thought that I believed that. I thought he was right. Another, you know, words of wisdom was, when you write a caption, never tell them what they can see for themselves. Joe Blow going left at Velzeeland is not a caption.
Right.
But Joe Blow had an argument with his girlfriend before he paddled out, and he was really angry, and he was just slashing back and forth out there in the water. That's a caption.
Yeah.
So those were invaluable little tips, because photography has been so hugely important to surfing as an information transmitter. And surfing is so sensory that surfers can look at photos and get a bit of the rush you actually feel from looking at it, but yeah. Mind surfing the photo. And it's a little bit different than other sporting photography, I think, in that sense. But word quality, we endeavor to print literature, and we also endeavor not to take ourselves too seriously. Because, you know, what Tubestick said, surfing's the toy department of human affairs, you know. But when you do a publication about anything, it tends to be about the people that do it. And people are fascinating. And the people that are interesting want to be described in a literate, probing, slightly unusual, surprising way.
Yeah.
And so that challenge became very satisfying, and it also, I think, earned us a dedicated following of people that were tired of the kid shit.
I agree. That's definitely true. Let me unpack that a little bit. I think surf writing faces a number of challenges, and one being that it's so easy to be just repetitive. We're going to the same places, surfing, doing the same act essentially in the same destinations. What is your approach to storytelling for the Surfer's Journal? How do you avoid that repetition?
Uh-huh. Well, we just try to delve deep into personal experience and feelings and I hate to use the word, but intellectualizing a little bit about something or pondering it or, and there's some writers that are quite good at looking at surfing in a fresh way.
Okay.
Matt Warshaw,
yeah,
is loaded with history and wields it in a completely fresh way, usually in an off the cuff side shots and commentary that are witty and knowledgeable. He's a good surfer, and that's kind of, you know, it's interesting to have a kook tell you how he perceives surfing. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And to have a great surfer explain the nuance is also interesting. So I think there's an opportunity for provocative content in almost anything if you look for that.
Yeah.
That would be the answer to your question.
Speaking of the Surfer's Journal specifically coming from Surfer Magazine, can you talk about the luxury of inflating an idea rather than mm-hmm. contracting it? Because I know I've heard you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. We run about 8 to 11 features in the center well. Our center well, I think, 110 pages. The center well of a typical issue of Surfer is 40 to 50 pages.
Okay.
So we've run articles 50 pages long.
What article was that?
I think it was on the life story of Nat Young. It was 50,000 words,
yeah, yeah.
And Drew Campion did it, and the article was as large as Nat's ego, and no one had ever done anything like that in a surf magazine, and I don't think anyone will again.
I was going to say, in hindsight, was it successful?
Well, it was in the sense that that we did it because we could, nobody else could.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was prudent.
Okay.
Because if you didn't give a shit about Nat Young, half the book was about something you didn't care about.
Sure.
You know. But but so, you know, and we're in our 23rd year, finishing our 23rd year, and we're doing 6 issues a year. And there's never, and when you publish a magazine, you create a gravity that pulls things towards you. People, you attract material more than think it up.
Hmm.
And a lot of times we get photography and look for words to go with, or we get words and look for photography to go with.
Yeah.
And we order stories, but most of the content comes over the transom, or we're approached by the writer or the photographer. So we don't have to sit around scratching our head thinking about abstract ideas as much as we should, perhaps, because it's so easy to fill the pages with colored dots as it comes in. But our sieve is pretty tight.
Okay.
And so the requirements on material, sometimes if material is not written elegantly, but it's real authentic, we'll bite. You know, there's a lot of different rationalizations we use to print things, but
I think there's a lot, obviously, of new platforms that are emerging, like this podcast for one, where it's a great way to distribute surf content a different way. Obviously, photography is expanded a lot in videography just due to technological advancements. What are the strengths and the limitations of print?
Well, the immediacy is a limitation. It takes months for a subject to translate to print in our process. But the plus is that there's still a valuable reward from holding a tangible object in your hand and looking at it and knowing where it is in the mass of material and being able to turn the page and not looking at small little bites that you rotate quickly.
Yeah.
You can look, and so you're looking at a line in the context of a page, in the context of a bunch of pages. So the whole experience of it is quite different than looking at a screen. Still photographs, we take advantage of space and design in our philosophy to run photographs that are a bit of a surprise sometimes. We'll take a photograph that might just be a small sidebar photo and make a full page out of it. And we try to stay away from cliche photos as much as we can. But I think that the tangible aspect of print, if it's worthwhile holding in your hand, which is our challenge, that there'll always be a place for it. But the generations, I have 26-year-old twin boys and a 43-year-old. The 26-year-old twins still read things. One reads books, the other doesn't touch them. His kids won't be used to that, reading books and reading newspapers as much. So I think there'll be an attrition over time, and I don't know where it's going, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone does, because there could be a backlash.
Right.
But and the journalist has supported our family's life for 23 years, and we could stop now, and it would be okay. And one of the reasons we don't is because it's a support mechanism for a whole bunch of families, and also that there seems to be a passionate readership that deserves to be fed. You know, they're hungry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Let's talk about kind of the act of surfing itself. Working in the surf industry, I've struggled with managing that relationship. Like in the past, I'd have to go surfing to feel like I was being a part of surfing. Now it's like I wake up and I'm coming to interview you. Well, this is kind of part of surfing for me, so I don't go to the beach this morning. But then a week or two pass where I've been doing things that relate to surfing, but I haven't actually done the act of surfing itself, you know, because I'm satisfied in certain ways.
Interesting, yeah.
What has your relationship like managing the act of surfing versus production of surf content over the last 50 years? How has that evolved?
Well, I used to be an everyday surfer,
uh-huh.
and I was for a long time. And I haven't surfed for 10 years.
Oh, really?
I have a bad hip and bad shoulders.
When you say you haven't surfed for 10 years, literally you haven't gone surfing once?
Pretty much.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I've ridden a few waves, but I can't sit on a board because of my hips. I play singles tennis 3 times a week, doubles on weekends. So I'm not a couch potato.
Yeah.
But but I surfed. I started surfing in the late 50s, and I stopped surfing probably around 2000 when I stopped surfing. So I had, you know, 40 plus years of surfing, and that gave me an understanding of the ride, the basic core experience of it. And the culture around it goes through transitions, and I know the culture that existed during the first 30 years of my surfing life. And as I got older and more removed from it, I know less and less about it. So I don't describe surfing from a standpoint that you would. But what I do is use my perspective, which is seasoned by being a student of the topic for 60 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a perspective. When you publish a magazine or work in a magazine or in media, you're at the hub of all these information streams that are coming at you, the surfers, the readers, the contributors, the staff, and the industry. And a lot of it sticks to you, and it's an unusual flow of information and its intensity and variety. And so you end up accumulating enough of it on your person that you have a unique perspective of the thing. And so I share that when I have something to say, but I'm talking more about philosophy of surfing or things that I've observed over large time frames. Like I observed that if you look at the ground around your feet and you see what's going on, the geology of the ground around your feet, then you look at the ground from 38,000 feet in an airplane out the window, it's the same thing, just on a different scale. So you begin to say, oh, everything gets infinitely bigger and smaller, and we get to see a certain range of it. But just what we can perceive doesn't mean that's where it stops.
Sure.
And so you kind of start to apply that kind of thing to surfing, and you can ruminate about it in an interesting way that's a little bit different than what you'll find from people who don't have the train that I have, that I've been riding on. And I don't, that's not an ego thing. It's just a byproduct of what I've done.
I was talking to Carl Ekstrom about board design, and he explained something fairly similar, kind of unintentionally actually, but it was like, he was explaining his, asymmetrical design evolution and how it evolved just from surfing and understanding that the board needed to respond a certain way, and design adjustment would allow him to do that. And later in the conversation explained that he hasn't surfed in 25 years, but his design has continued to evolve over that time. And so then, I had to ask, well, like, if the design is fully based on what's happening in the water, how have you evolved past that without being in the water? And it was kind of a similar explanation where it was just like, I can still perceive the experience of being in the water because I did it so intensely.
You have a basis for understanding it. I call it mind surfing. I watch surfing.
Yeah.
And I feed on watching surfing.
Right.
And so I'll look at how a person rides, and I'll look at the wave and figure out where I would have taken off, or all that stuff. And so you continue to experience it, watch it, and understand a lot of it. But there's a lot of it that I don't understand. Like, I don't know, I cannot for the life of me understand riding slabs, for instance, because it's just, they look horrific, and I don't know if I could get myself to paddle into one, or it's just that realm of experience is beyond my realm of understanding.
Right.
But the basic thing of paddling for a wave and catching it is very much in Carl's breadbasket, and to a certain extent in mine. And he's, a very interesting guy. He and Maury and Stan Pleskounas and George Greeno are kind of the Buckminster Fullers of the surfing world.
Yeah.
And it's really a treat to spend time with them and have them just trip you out on totally. What they're into.
Totally. Anybody who kind of exercises in the morning, tennis or whatever it happens to be, knows how that improves the rest of your day and just your outlook on life and your relationships and all that kind of stuff. How is surfing as that morning activity different than just going to spin class at the gym or something like that?
Well, that speaks to the difference between surfing and all those other things. And it's different things to different people, but I think there's this sounds kind of corny, but you know, the sun is the source of life for as we know it. And it's the warmth of the sun that creates the friction, that moves the air, that makes the swells, that creates the waves that we've learned to paddle into and ride. Mm-hmm. So you're connecting to this very core energy. And there's something deeply engrossing and satisfying and rewarding about it. And I don't know if it has anything to do with that or if it's just we're just fun hogs, you know.
Yeah.
But I always used to say if you've surfed, any day's a good day. Doesn't matter what else happens. It's really, that's about what you were saying.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's like a meditation. And it gets confused with all the animal behavior of the human being. But other mammals do it too.
Yeah.
And you know, humans are kind of angry and greedy and awkward, but some are gorgeous, you know. Mm-hmm. Phil Edwards was elegant. He was Brishnikov. There's others too now. Yeah, but, yeah. You know.
That kind of was an intentional segue into the conversation about Timothy Leary. Can you tell me about the conversation you had with him that was featured in 1978 issue of Surfer Magazine?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have specific questions about it as well.
Leary, at one point in the earlier 70s, he'd been hiding out. I think he was a fugitive. He was, you know, an LSD. He was a drug proponent. But he was also a Harvard professor, bright guy. And what he saw in the psychedelic experience was sort of maybe a little bit on a lesser scale than we got riding a wave.
Sure.
And he saw a parallel between surfing and the free mind. And he was doing a lecture series, going around to colleges and lecturing. And I can't think of the Watergate figure who was lecturing with him as the foil to Leary.
Okay.
A super conservative redneck guy.
I don't know that guy.
But John's, or Leary's speech, his segment was entitled Man, the Evolutionary Surfer. So at that time, it was unusual for mainstream society to reference surfing, or you didn't see billboards and ads on TV and stuff like you do now. And so, and Leary was being kept by a think tank in Huntington Beach that was sort of new age and experimental, and so he was associated with them for a while, and they would kind of leverage him for whatever value, and they leverage each other, and so we called and asked if he would come down and be interviewed, And this guy in a Mercedes from the think tank drove him down to Surfer Magazine office, and I interviewed him. And later we went down to the beach at San Clemente, and Art Burr shot some photos of us. And
was he a surfer?
No.
Okay.
But he'd been around the Brotherhood of Eternal Love in Laguna Beach, and a lot of those guys were surfers, and so he began to see surfers as a sympathetic cultural segment to his viewpoints.
Okay.
And so we found conversationally sort of a common ground, because he was describing surfing in a way that resonated for me, and I was describing surfing in a way that resonated for him.
Yeah.
And his key thought was that surfers were the throwaheads of man on earth rather than the dregs, because they were living for the moment. Mm-hmm. And they learned and they valued that above all else.
Right.
And that the destiny of man was to evolve to live in a purely aesthetic reality. And surfers were constructing that now for themselves. And the tube ride was the epitome of be here now. Mm-hmm. The past, the present, the future and the present. And so he really respected what surfers did, and the fact that a philosopher, albeit an LSD high priest, certified, appreciated the act was very compelling, very interesting. And I was really lame at the time. Like, I spelled T-A-O-D-O-W like Dow Jones in the article. I remember I was always horrified by that later on.
He had a really, I'm surprised that he wasn't a surfer, because he had a really keen understanding of the nuance of it. You know, the things that you would think only, you would only know if you had participated in it for a long period of time.
Yeah, and since he hadn't, there was obviously some common ground in the two experiences of his philosophical basis. And the surfing experience illustrated it to him, or was a metaphor.
Yeah.
And so that was very gratifying. And I thought it was, you know, just really interesting. And he didn't seem to me to be an evil guy. Of course, I was smoking pot and taking acid. And so I wasn't like, he didn't offend me.
Sure.
But he was viewed as a pariah by mainstream society.
I'll read one of the quotes from that piece. He said, "Everything is made up of waves. Electrons and neurons travel in waves. Historical waves, cultural waves. In nature and life, things come packaged in sequential, cyclical, moving, ever-changing forms." And then one of the things that you guys discuss is that surfers have figured out a way to basically ride those waves and to participate in that exchange of energy from Mother Nature, and arguably are the only form that has figured out a way how to really ride those waves. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the piece was that it unpacks a quality of surfing that I've always had a hard time articulating, and I think you referred to it as a head game in a fluid medium. And, you know, that
I was probably stoned.
Do you remember that quote?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought it was summed up really well. Or I think Leary put it, the merging of your body's neuromusculature with power, energy, rhythm of nature.
Yeah. He's integrating, which is a very broad overview and really exciting.
Yeah, but I think that we can all relate to that. And it exists in golf a little bit, where it's such a head thing, you know? And if you aren't fully just living in the moment, or if you're trying to remember the mechanics of your swing or the mechanics of how to ride a wave, you've already lost the experience.
Right, yeah.
You need to just learn it in advance and then shut down and let your
body
take over,
right,
or nature take over.
Right.
Just yesterday, I was watching this new web internet series on the surfer Clay Marzo, Maui kid from Maui, who has Asperger's, and in interviewing all the people around him, one of the main things they talk about is his ability just to live in the moment when he's on a wave. That's one of the key things with Asperger's, characteristics of Asperger's, is hyper-focus. And you can only do it on one or two things, but whatever your thing is...
They're a savant on that topic.
Yeah, you become the Rain Man of that.
One of our sons is Asperger's.
Oh, really?
We have twin boys, and one works here, and one is a welder, and the welder is very high-functioning. Yeah. Asperger's, but yeah, I'm familiar with the focus.
Yeah.
Because they perseverate on minutiae, and that allows them to do things. There's some functional applications of that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so with Clay Marzo, it's surfing, you know, mm-hmm. and he is a savant. He's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think Kelly Slater has that to a degree, and other great surfers where there's this oneness with the ocean, this ability to just kind of exist in the moment and be able to anticipate, you know, that the third set wave's going to be better than the first or whatever that happens to be. That's something, that intuition, I think, is something that I really enjoyed about that piece with Timothy Leary, is my point, is that mm-hmm. he's really trying to understand the patterns involved in waves and the way that the Earth works.
Yeah, well, I think you got more from that piece than a lot of people did, but it was all there.
Mm.
That was all there, and I think it's very perceptive of you.
One of the things that you, another quote from you in that piece, was that surfing is non-productive and non-depletive.
Right.
I think that's an interesting thing. Can you talk about that quote?
Well, when you finish surfing, that was part Leary when he said, surfing leaves no trace of itself. Your footprints are washed from the beach. And so it's done something purely for the aesthetic moment. And that was the whole thing about surfing. It has no purpose other than the art of the dance. And in fact, surfing, I think, is really a dance form. Just you dance on a wave versus a solid stage. But and so Leary's idea was that man would eventually abandon Earth and create his own structural home, and that will surf across the cosmos on waves of cosmic energy. And he said, you know, as far out as that sounds, he said, if you believe that that can happen, then you have to work to make it happen. You can't just sit back and have it happen.
It's your obligation.
You have to become an advocate and work towards that. And then you're lifting human civilization to another place.
Which is easy to theorize, but what does that look like in terms of application?
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
And
it could be 1,000 generations down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Well, you know, there's a tribe of Indians called the Pequeño or something, and they lived at Warner Springs, at the hot springs that later became Warner Springs, and they were the only tribe that... They harvested acorns. They were the only tribe that planted oak trees for future generations. I thought that was interesting. You
said
only human society that did things for the future generations.
Interesting. One more kind of thought about that non-productive and non-depletive statement. This surfing dance is purely aesthetic, and it defines your aesthetic in the real world, actually, but it leaves no trace.
It's interesting because you can see who a person is when they when you watch them dance. Huh? They're defensive or fluid or jerky, so that's an interesting. It's an interesting exhibition.
Yeah.
But
it defines your aesthetic for the rest of your life, but it has zero meaning or zero kind of value in and of itself.
It doesn't create anything useful.
Right.
It's just for the joy of the sensation.
Right.
And the feeling of being in harmony and succeeding. A goal, like a goal might be to make a section, and if you make it, you feel good.
Right. That that conversation that you had with him seems to be kind of played an important role in you and your career.
Well, I was, my father always was just freaked out that I'd gotten swept up in being a surfer. But I found this huge, rewarding, undefinable quality to it that allowed me to let it take me away and consume me. And Leary helped me understand what the value of it was that was so worthwhile.
Right.
To dedicate your life to it.
Right.
And that became a kind of a philosophical platform for my understanding of the sport.
One of the other things that you said in there was that surfing gives you a very elemental illustrations of broader truths because it serves kind of as a microcosm that we can grasp. I think it does. You know, surfing has a metaphor for life in it. Do you want to talk any more about that? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
Surfing is the ocean is a teacher. And it will take a jagged rock and turn it into a round pebble. And it will take a jagged person and turn them into a smooth person if the person lets it.
Right.
And so you learn things from surfing that you can apply to life in many, many ways. So there is a value to the school of the University of the Ocean when you're a speck of lint on the face of a wave at Waimea Bay, you realize that the body can survive forces that would break a rigid thing into pieces, and you realize the power of your brain, and you realize that the power of the wave is the only part of the wave you have to deal with is the part where you're touching it. So the immense power of the totality is not your concern. And when you're riding a surfboard, it's just the wetted surface that... Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot of things that happen, like you become confident, oh, I can survive that. Oh, that's possible. It doesn't look possible, but it is. Oh, wow. Things that don't look possible can be possible. That's a big lesson. Too much rocker slows you down, too flat catches edges, all those things trim. You can trim your way through life. And if you become confident in the ocean, I think that transfers.
Can you think of were there any other like transformative conversations or interviews that you had with people over the years stand out?
Well, philosophically, not so much, but just wonderful tidbits and anecdotal things. You know, George Downing, Dorian Paskowitz, Phil Edwards, Mickey Munoz. Listening to them talk in a relaxed way about things they've learned or funny things is really, you know, incredible. And they each, like Phil Edwards and Mickey, their lives are completely about the ocean. And Phil, when he stopped surfing and started sailing, tried to explain to me that he didn't stop surfing. He just got into a longer trim. And I was too, you know, I didn't get that when he told me. I got it later. And Munoz's, the title of his book was There's No Bad Waves. And so what he's saying is George Greeno has detuned his surfing to ride a deflated surf mat in shore break junk. And he finds art in that.
Yeah.
So he avoids the crowds, and it's just kind of a reverse intellectualism, and you watch Lopez in the ocean, and he's a greedy motherfucker, but he's so, from the moment he enters the water till when he comes out, it's just poetry.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not apologetic about taking waves, and why should he be?
Right.
So I don't know if it's that bad a deal, you know, because he's a beautiful person.
Right.
So I don't know. It's interesting. It's like surfing, a surf break like Laura Trussell's is like wolf pack behavior. The young ones dominate. The older ones get driven off to the marginal food. It's all just kind of biological design.
Yeah.
Because that's the human behavior injecting itself into riding a wave.
Right.
So it's interesting to, if you separate those things, like you watch a dolphin ride a wave, or, you know, a sea creature, and they just kind of, they frolic, and they probably have social interaction too during the course of it, I would guess.
Yeah, I would think so.
So, if only we could listen to them.
Yeah. Changing gears a little bit, a lot actually. Did you watch the Bells Beach contest the last couple of days?
No.
Do you have any interest at all in competitive surfing?
Yeah.
You do?
Sure.
Okay.
I as a topic for our journalism, I don't, covering a specific contest doesn't interest me,
right.
But inspecting competition as a form in surfing, I think is interesting, and it's imbued in the human nature. Like I remember, the only contest when I started was Makaha, and we'd get into, hey, I can surf better than you can. No, you can't. Okay, we'll get Joe and Blow to watch us, and we'll go out. So it's just you know.
Yeah.
But it's. The fact that surfing is now so communicated and so visually transferred, and it's available and everything, and the commentary is pretty intelligent too. Some of the, they'll have knowledgeable surfers commenting on what they're watching.
Yeah.
So I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
And if the waves are good, it's really like they had a thing on Cloudbreak some time ago that was as good as anything you could watch in terms of the waves and the commentary and the experience that you were seeing happen.
Yeah.
Pretty dynamite.
Yeah.
So I think competitive surfing is quite interesting, and it's a valid form of surfing that's different than free surfing. But I think surfing has been shrink-wrapped and packaged and distributed and modified and made convenient for packaging and distribution and all those things. And a lot of that was, the absence of that was what was beautiful about it.
Right.
When I started.
Right.
And so I resent a lot of it. But my 26-year-old son doesn't, because he doesn't know any different.
Yeah.
To him, these are the good old days.
Right.
It's just a cycle, you know.
Talking about how you can't really relate to that experience of wanting to ride a slab seems kind of similar. The contest experience, it's almost a different thing entirely, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, timed, being judged for prescribed things, having a criteria for surfing that doesn't leave room for invention too much or variance or... So, as I said in a recent piece, surfing today is really kind of judged by the radicalness of maneuvers that everyone's doing. And who can do the most radical version of them is considered the best.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of like gymnastics.
Right.
It's like clones trying to be better at a certain thing.
Right. Well, in relation to our earlier conversation about aesthetic being the foundation of surfing, essentially, and the embodiment of surfing has to do with aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
the judging criteria doesn't make any accommodation for style at all. It intentionally leaves style out of
it. It's too subjective.
Because it's too subjective.
Yeah.
But that does seem counterintuitive to the original act.
Yeah. If you think about surfing around the turn of the century, and it was just people riding in on planks to the beach. And then when they put fins on surfboards, it became competitive because you went laterally across the wave.
Yeah.
And there was only room for one. When you're going straight into the beach, you could all ride the same wave. It was a party. So that changed the dynamic of surfing quite a bit. And when someone mentioned that to me, I thought it was really interesting. It had never dawned on me that that was like a crucible of that one moment when surfing, when the angling, which left, you know, one person can go this way and this way, but 10 can go like that. So, and then style, but style was, I think, present.
I think so.
Back then, in the regal
posture. It changes the, that angling, though, changes the dynamic from being a group activity to being a very singular.
That's right. That's right. And so then there comes a competition for the resource.
Right.
That was a new dimension.
Exactly.
And it's still with us.
Stronger than ever, actually.
And what about man-made waves? How do those figure into the equation? You know, I think they're perfectly all right and a legitimate form of recreation. But when they want to have surfing be in the Olympics and be and occur in wave pools because that would facilitate it, I think, go ahead and do it, but just don't call it surfing.
Right.
Because surfing is about interfacing with nature. That's a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to build a gym that happens to be fluid and where waves are the side horses in the rings, go ahead. But just and that there's nothing wrong with it.
Sure.
It's bitching. I mean, to have a dynamic pool with waves in it out in some landlocked place where kids can play in that instead of just a static body of water,
mm-hmm.
absolutely great.
But
then again, people are willing to, when they package surfing, they always lessen it.
Yep.
Because they trim away.
Yeah,
so, and you know, what's wrong with that? I don't know. You know, it's not like it's wrong. It just pisses me off.
It's just not the natural
no.
state.
Yeah, and there's something about protecting the core value, you know, that seems worth doing.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the journal is trying to do in a way. Well, I don't have anything to do with selecting articles.
Okay.
Or editing them or writing captions, but I am more about the philosophy of the process and coaching the editor, Scott and Alex Wilson and whoever our team is at the moment to keep them, so to help them express the values that were the core values we were trying to express, but that's the trunk. They're putting the leaves on it, you know.
Yeah.
And they should be. I shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And it will change. The publication will change with the chemistry set of the humans that do it. But if the core vision of surfing as an art form, as a human social bundle of all those things, as long as that kind of is there, I think the integrity of it will survive the absence of my presence, which ultimately will happen one way or another.
Right.
Two jumps in a week. I bet you think that's pretty clever, don't you, boy?
It's, you know, and the role of media is so is being redefined right now. And so the destiny of this publication is really open to conjecture. But I think that there'll be a place for the tangible worth holding in your hand. But the question is how many, if the audience for it shrinks, that means the price goes up.
Right.
And so that there may be a life cycle in play there. We'll see.
I know it's been 10 years. Final question for everybody I interview is, what was the last surfboard you rode?
It was a Phil Edwards. It's right out there on the floor. Just a one-stringer, speedy shape, longboard, 10-2. That was always my length.
Where'd you ride it?
Probably middles. I used to live for lowers.
Yeah.
And then I segued down a little bit, so I didn't get my ass chewed it so much.
Right.
Well, actually, it was ego, because I hate to get in people's way.
Oh, okay.
And so I don't mind surfing behind, but I don't like to be in front.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and it's just not cool, you know. It's not where I started.
Right. Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
That was fun.
Excellent. Don't leave me dry.
Don't leave me high. Don't leave me dry.
We have Steve's full article with Timothy Leary from that 1978 issue of Surfer Magazine on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. Thank you, Steve Pesman, for all of your work over the years. The Surfer's Journal is an absolute treasure to the surfing community. We are very grateful for your contributions. If you'd like to subscribe to the Surfer's Journal, we'll have a link to their website on surfsplendorpodcast.com. If you enjoyed today's show, make sure to share it with a friend. It's easy to do via social media, where you can follow us at Surf Splendor on Instagram and Twitter, or on Facebook.com/Surf Splendor. If you listen to the show in iTunes or Stitcher, just make sure to rate and review the show. That's a great way to help other people find the show. As you know, you, the listener, are our only form of advertising. So anything that you can do to help promote or share the show, we are greatly appreciative. It's your way to invest in the future of the show. The more people who are listening, the more shows we will be able to produce. So thanks as always for listening. This is your host, David Scales, for Surf Splendor, saying we will see you next week with an all-new episode. Mahalo.